Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 353rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and as I have been for 352 other episodes, I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta in Edmonton.
And that's the same as it has been for 352 podcasts.
Well, except for, yeah, started out as cleaning staff.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, gradually, you worked your way up.
Yeah, gradually worked myself. I worked that, the floor polisher, I was, yeah.
Yeah, you're now a marginal co-host. So for those of you who follow along, in our last episode, it was thrilling. There's no other words to describe it other than boring. We are taking a deep dive into the concepts of lab testing, and we talked a little bit about earlier on about the actual true lab errors that we see, and it's about 0.3%. So they do happen, but not all that often. And then we talked a little bit about the actual population-based reference intervals, the ones that you see on the lab report, that they are, you know, purely taken from healthy people. And now we want to get into a discussion of the variability associated with each measurement, because I think it's really important to realize that, you know, whenever you get a lab result back, even though it gives you an exact number, it really is, you need to be aware that it's actually a range that's anywhere from plus or minus 1 or 2%, or even as high as 20 or 30%, and Mike, as you know, even higher than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm looking forward. You've got some really exciting formulas to share with the listeners, like some cosine stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
Angle of the hypotenuse. It's going to be riveting.
Yeah, don't give it away. we'll go there.
Keep them wanting more.
Yeah. So this is going to get a little bit geeky, but let's see if you can help.
Oh, man. As opposed to the other 352.
Exactly. So when you get, there's a concept in the lab world, and it's called reference change values, or RCVs. And what that means is we can do some statistical testing to know if a certain lab test has changed. If there's a serial result that you have the first one and the second one, we can do some statistical assessment of that to see if we can rule out that it's just due to chance. Now, here's the thought process. If every test was the exact result and we did a second one, it was different, then we could easily say those two have changed because they are different numbers. But unfortunately, we can't say that about them. There's always a variation around each lab test. And I'm not going to actually even get into the terms of coefficients of variation. We're going to just try and keep it much more simple. Here's the way to think about it. Every time you do a lab test, there is the analytic imprecision or the analytic variation around it. So that's to do with the lab test, the errors associated with it. If you remember back our previous podcast, it's the tape measure problem of not knowing exactly where to put it. It might have kinks in it. That's the So every test has an analytic imprecision. And interestingly, that's not the biggest deal. The biggest deal for most of it is the biologic variation, which is the natural fluctuation, if you will, of cholesterols, of blood pressures, of anything that we're sort of measuring. And that's called the biologic variation. There is a way, so any variation for an individual test is based on the combination of analytical and biological variation. And one needs to be aware of that. And as Mike said, there is a fancy formula, and I don't even want to say it because it does involve a square root, the number 1.96, and squaring
square roots,
the square root of 2, and squaring things. And it really, it's mind-numbingly boring, but it's very, very important. So let's try and put it into context. So given that every test has a variability around it because of the analytic and biologic variation, you can do some statistical tests to say, what is the minimum difference between two consecutive results which needs to be exceeded so that one can state that there's a statistically significant change has taken place? Or the way we report it is, you know, have we ruled out that the difference is probably not due to chance? And we see that in all, whenever we do p-values for other things, right, Mike?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, that's sort of where we're going with this.
I'm kind of hung up, James. Now, you said that biologic variation, so basically within person variation, yes, is the major culprit in variation. So when you discuss results that have changed with a patient, do you say to them, the reason that this has changed or it's variable is because of you? You're to blame for this?
Oh, it's 100% their fault.
So it's a fault issue.
Yes.
I like it. I like the way you think.
Yeah, I just tell them, look, stop changing.
Patient-centered. Yeah, I like it.
Exactly.
It's focusing on them as the problem.
Yeah. So again, and if anyone's interested, you can go back, you can go to the whole calculations and formula, and you just have to trust that we've almost done a marginally good job of looking at this. But when the lab groups, when they do the analytical testing, what they do is they attempt, and they are very, actually quite successful at this, they attempt to get the analytic variation to be at least less than one half the average within subject variation, which is the biologic variation within an individual. When one does that, so if you can have the analytic variation be a half of the within subject, interestingly, the analytic variation really plays very little role in the day-to-day variation that you will see with lab tests. So the main problem we're going to talk about, the main variation, is impossible to fix. If it was analytical, we could make the test better. But I can tell you right now, when you look at most tests, the test is actually very, very good. The analytic variation is almost, for most things, is less than one half, and in fact, much often much less than that. So the variation that we are talking about cannot actually be fixed. I don't know if that makes sense.
So what you're saying, I get you. You're saying that medical science, good. Patients bad.
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Good. We're just summing up, trying to keep it focused.
Yeah. And so the way that we look at these sort of reference change values is we can sort of rule out whether we're statistically different or not. Now, Mike, I'm not sure if we've talked about this, but we've talked about the problem of p-values. Have we done that before?
No, I don't think we've mentioned anything about statistics. This is the first real podcast to get into anything.
Statistics. Yeah. So we are fully aware that when we're talking about this, we are delving into what is often referred to as science's dirtiest secret.
Again, when you say often, by you.
Yeah.
To anyone who listens.
Yeah, and as people have said, and these are quotes, there are numerous deep flaws in null hypothesis significant testing. One quote was, statistical techniques for testing hypotheses have more flaws than Facebook's privacy policies. I appreciate that. So even though we're going to be talking about that and saying, well, this difference is not statistically significantly different, or it is, we realize that it's based somewhat on the faulty premise of that if it's a p-value of less than 0.05, that means that it's important. We get that, but unfortunately, that's the standard that we're going to be working in. And what we will hopefully do is give you the problem associated with that. And the reason that's an important thing is because we can do a statistical test between two different numbers, and we can say that from a p-value of 0.05 that we believe these results are different, and that the difference seen is probably not due to chance. So we can do that with this reference change values thing we're going to talk about. But that does not necessarily then mean that the difference you've seen is the actual difference, because each test has a variability. So again, I'm going to keep asking you, Mike, to make sure I've even marginally made sense. But just because one can say we think we've seen a significant difference, that doesn't then mean that if you've got a potassium of 5 and now a potassium of 6, and those are statistically different, that we now know the difference is 1.
Yeah, you can't say the difference is 1, but you can say it's gotten worse.
Yeah, or it's gone up or down,
which is worse in this case.
Yes, exactly.
If it was starting at 3 and it went up to 4, that's not necessarily getting worse.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. You can't apply precision to the difference seen, because it's all you're saying is there is a difference and it's heading in this direction.
Yeah.
The degree around it is unclear.
Yeah.
But when you were speaking, you did lose me a bit. Now, who am I again?
Many listeners have asked that question for 353 episodes. Let's not go there, Mike, because it makes you cry.
Okay, good.
Okay. So, and now here's another important relative point. if you do many measurements and in many different people, and for instance, if you were to do a very large study of cholesterol levels and so on, when you do that and you do thousands of tests and thousands of people, that variation is eliminated. And when you see that a drug lowers a cholesterol by 20%, you can be fairly comfortable, and it probably is right around 20%, because when you do multiple measurements, you actually lose that. The biological variation takes care of itself with all these multiple measurements and so on and so forth. So that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about the use of these things in thousands of people, but we're talking about the individual patient where you get two results. Now, some people, and you've said it and I've said it in previous things, is, well, what about if you do more than one measurement? Can you reduce the variability? And the answer is yes, but there's a caveat to that. But, you know, people do repeat measurements, right?
That's all I do.
Yeah, I know. Because now you don't believe anyone, so you just keep repeating it until your patient's lost the will to live.
Until they can't stand me anymore and go see someone else. No, yeah. We all do that. We all get caught in this trap of repeating a test or two because, goodness, maybe this is just they're one of the people that sits at the higher or lower range of this test that's slightly abnormal right now. If I repeat it, maybe in the normal range, and I can rest assured that that's just them.
Yeah.
So, we all do this. We all and there isn't – I doubt there's a single person in practice who hasn't said more than once, I wish I never ordered that test.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe even more now that they're listening to this podcast. So if you do a single test, there's a way of coming up with a number, and we're going to give you all these numbers. I promise you, maybe not even this podcast, we're going to leave you at the end again wanting more. So if you just do a test and then another one afterwards, you get there's a particular number, a reference change value, which says if you exceed this potential amount, we are ruling out that it's chance. If you do four measurements before and four afterwards, you lower that range by 50%. So let's say you need a 10% change to rule out the fact that it was just due to chance. If you do four measurements before and four afterwards, it lowers it from 10% to 5%, but it doesn't eliminate it. And I'm going to ask you, it would be quite unusual to have someone do four measurements before and then four measurements afterwards, add them together, get the average. No one does that.
No, that would be, not only would it be poor care, but it would be cruel to the patient.
Exactly.
On top of just, being an inappropriate use of resources, all sorts of things. So no one does that, at least not intentionally. Now we end up doing some things like that because I send for a test, the eMERGE doctor who just saw this patient sent for the same test, and so on. And so you end up with a collection of values around the same time. Or you see someone who has a low or high value of something and they went to eMERGE related to that, and then it was repeated. And so sometimes you get – and then they'll be repeated again and again. And so.
And now what you've done doing that, you've actually added in another variability that we haven't even talked about, which is lab-to-lab variability.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just – it's a gong show is what we're trying to say. So what I thought would be useful is, and like I say, we will get to numbers.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that something we're going to do in this podcast is going to be useful?
No.
Okay, good. Good, because I don't want to set too high an expectation. No.
So I think probably the best way to sort of approach this is to talk about a variety of examples. Are you okay with that?
I'm okay.
You're all over that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and we've talked about this particular one in the past, but we're putting it into the context of lab values, or if you will, just measurements in medicine. So bone density. So we're going to talk about bone density because we've talked about this in the past, but it bears repeating in this context. If you look at some older clinical practice guidelines, they recommend attaining a baseline DEXA scan to identify how the bone density, and then repeat it every 1 to 2 years until findings are stable, and continue with follow-up DEXA every 2 years or less frequent interval. Now, part of the problem with doing that is that sounds quite reasonable, doesn't it? That's the problem with most guidelines.
Yeah. No, it's it passes the logic test. Unless if you look at the evidence, then it falls apart. But if you think about it without actually understanding the limitations of, of what you're doing, it sounds great. It sounds thorough and comprehensive and careful.
Yeah. And so, and here's the, one of the reasons I'm using bone density, because I think most people can appreciate that things like blood pressure change probably minute to minute. Glucose, probably the same. Your sodium varies naturally during the day, during the week, it's so on and so forth. I think most people would suggest that bone density is bone density. It doesn't change minute to minute. You know what I'm saying?
Well, we hope not.
We hope it doesn't. If it did, it'd be very cool. Now, maybe you're turning into the Hulk.
Or you're, again, traveling in space, because apparently lose bones quite quickly there, bone density.
Yeah.
I haven't, but I've heard from friends.
So in this case, you see much less biologic variation. The main variation, or at least an important part of the variation, is just the analytic variation that's associated with it. So let's go through some math. On a year-to-year basis, given everything else being equal, we lose about 0.5% of our bone. So as we age,
do you know where you lose it?
It's actually a not well known fact. It's your left middle toe. unknown fact.
All the bone density from the rest of your body is going there.
Yeah, exactly. There's a mechanism. I don't want to get into it.
Okay.
So that's 0.5%. Now, if you were to give a medication to someone for bone density, the difference between drug and placebo at 3 years, which is the typical study that's done it, is about 5%. So every year we lose about 0.5%. If we give a drug, on average, bone density is about 5% different. You're building bone density. You may be, but the difference between that and placebo is about 5%. Now, the precision of a bone density test is roughly, and this is with using the same machine and all those sorts of things, is roughly, and it's getting a little bit better in the last couple of years, but it's, for ballparking, we say it's about plus or minus 2 to 3%. So that's just the test precision. So as you can imagine, Mike, if you just did a annual bone BMD and you on average see a 0.5% reduction, you can't pick that up
for 5 years.
Yeah, you can't pick that test up when the precision of your instrument is plus or minus 2 to 3%. But here's where it gets tricky. It does change because of that plus or minus 2 to 3%, and you will think it's gone up or down. And that's the exact point of why we're doing these podcasts.
Oh yeah, no, it causes no end to frustration to patients, and so they get a minus 2.6 and. Mm-hmm. They end up on bisphosphonate therapy. You've calculated their risk. They're willing to take it. And you were enthused enough to repeat the test. Mm-hmm. And it comes back. And it was minus 2.6. And now it's minus 2.7. And they say, oh, my God, it's gotten worse.
Yeah. That just annoys me. But that's, again, because we can appreciate that the person's height doesn't change in a few seconds. But we assume that the test is giving us these two different numbers and that the differences are important. So that's one of the reasons why a number of people, including us when we did the tools for practices, is that have said, do not do repeat bone BMD testing once you've given a bisphosphonate, because all it does is just give you unnecessary and misleading results. And actually Mike Colburn and Chris and Tina did this.
Yeah, exactly. They were the ones and then we did another version of it in Canadian Family Physician.
Yeah.
And we originally said in the first 3 years, I would go 5 years, and I think with reasonable, I'd need to look at the evidence again, but I think you might be able to say never once you've started medicines. But anyhow, it's certainly not yearly or every 2 years.
Yeah, and you can't assess the response.
No.
Yeah. I mean, you can, but if you did, and you'd have to look at the numbers, if you did 10 measurements before, 10 measurements after, average them, you might be able to tease something out. But even that is tricky. And so other people have said that. And lo and behold, the American College of Physicians, they put out guidelines, as many groups do. The most recent guideline, 2017, on entitled Treatment of Low Bone Density or Osteoporosis to Prevent Fractures, states this: the data do not support monitoring bone density during the initial 5 years of treatment in patients receiving pharmacological agents to treat osteoporosis. Great. That's 10 years too late. But at least they've said it. And that's, as I have never, this is the only guideline I've ever seen say that. Because if you look at almost every other bone density guideline before that, they will say, here's what they will say. You remeasure it, and they will give you the, we're going to talk about reference change values, they'll say, this is the amount that it needs to change to be statistically significantly different. And they'll give you a whole bunch of reasons for how often to do it. But these guys have, if you do just very simple math, it shows you cannot use these tests. And so they're saying, just don't do it. And if you can envision, if you're not treating and the average bone loss per year is about 0.5%, a number of articles have come out and said, you probably don't ever need to necessarily repeat it. And certainly at most, maybe every 10 years, but people I'm sure get it every year.
Oh, well, we know they do.
Yeah.
I think right now or shortly after this was published, a small group of radiologists and endocrinologists met in a dark room together, created a likeness doll of the lead author and began sticking it repeatedly with pins.
So this is an example of the analytic variation of a test that is actually very good. Like it gives you a
2% variability, a 2 to 3% variability is... it's good.
Yeah. And the problem is the changes that occur and the changes when we use therapy are much smaller than that, or relatively smaller than that. So that's the problem of it. So it's not that it's not a good test. It's just a useless test.
It's not that it's not good. It's useless.
Yeah. So it's a very, and so are we saying that you don't need to do it? No. If you do a single test, it will give you a pretty good ballpark of where they are in bone density. And we've talked about this in previous podcasts about you can use that to make a ballpark estimate of fracture risk. And I don't think that's inappropriate. And it may be somewhat useful. So we're not saying it, but it's the monitoring that is probably of no value.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. I just recalled another example of a, and I'm going to put quotations around, lab error, mm-hmm. was with a BMD. Someone's BMD made no sense to me, mm-hmm. and it changed 2 points between readings.
So it went from like -2 to 0.
Yeah, something along those lines. Yeah, and it went up the opposite direction of what it should.
And I mean, if you really think about it, like, who was the idiot who decided that we're going to present bone density scores as a T score? I mean, and this is not, I'm not belittling anyone.
Except calling them an idiot.
No, but statistics are, people hate statistics, they get very confused. And so to do T-scores and you're comparing it to, an otherwise healthy Scandinavian woman who probably, runs around with 17 people on her back on a daily basis. Transporting them, and I'm.
Is that what they do in Scandinavia?
Yeah, I've not been there, but I've seen movies.
Okay.
So if you are going to report a test, I mean, I think the worst method would be to present it as a T score, because then people got to go figure out what the hell is a T score.
That is exactly the reason. I think honestly, many people get together in rooms and like, how can we make this as confusing as possible?
Exactly.
And that's if you have any doubt about that, go look at the original guidelines for osteoporosis with the minor and major risk factors for Canada.
God, it's painful. Painful. Anyway, so that's one example. So let's do one more and then we'll go on to the next podcast. So the next example, and this is more, bone density, it is a sort of a lab test, I guess, but let's go on to a specific lab test, and that's cholesterol.
Yes.
Because this one is kind of cool because it's so much fun to look at the weirdness associated with measuring these things. So if you read the most recent Canadian guidelines from 2016, it says individuals with a modified Framingham risk score of 5 to 9%, which is sort of what people call moderate risk, they should do yearly monitoring to evaluate the change in risk. So again, we're back now to the sort of bone density sort of stuff. And even the most recent AACE 2017 guidelines said that lipid status should be reassessed 6 weeks after therapy initiation and again at 6-week intervals until the treatment goal is achieved. And while on stable lipid therapy, individuals should be tested at 6 to 12 month intervals.
Now, our guideline, James, the simplified lipid guideline doesn't quite recommend these.
No, we said don't do it.
We said do it every 7 weeks.
Yes, exactly, which is evidence-based. No, it's and again, here's the problem with it. This gut, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, because you're being careful.
I know.
You're trying to make sure that those, not to mention until they get to lipid targets, we don't have lipid targets, not defined by research.
Yeah. So that's in a whole other podcast. But anyway, we digress.
Don't let that stop us. Let's move on.
So let's talk about this. And the variation is an interesting thing to talk about because, and a number of people have written this about, you know, including some people that we know, Paul Glasziou from Australia and that the gang there that have done some really good work about. And one of the articles, and this is from a long time ago, this is like a decade ago, they wrote an article saying monitoring cholesterol levels, measurement error or true change. And so, we're going to talk in generalities here, but it all boils down to the analytic variability plus the biologic variability. And primarily in this case, it's not so much the analytic variability, but it's the within person variability that occurs here. So forget analytic variability for a second. The within person coefficient of variation, and what that just means is the sort of variability associated with it, is roughly around somewhere between 5 to 10%. The number that they talk is 7%. And if you look at how much does a person's cholesterol level change on average per year, it's actually very similar to what we talked about with bone density. It increases, in contrast to bone density, it increases by about a half to 1% per year. Go back to the thing is, so this test, just with the within-person variation, is plus or minus sort of 5 to 10%. You can't pick that up. It's worse than the bone density issue.
Oh, yeah. And I've seen numbers saying the variance can be as high as 13%.
So yeah, absolutely.
It's fascinating to me the amount of weight we put on these measurements, and especially when they themselves are then used to convert to risk estimates and things like that, which have another plus or minus around them. Like it's very interesting, our conviction that these numbers have such weight.
Yeah, exactly. No, and that's kind of why we're doing this. And this article from 2008 would suggest, well, after you see an initial change, only measure every 3 to 5 years. And even that is debatable. I think they probably just went, look, we got to say something. You know, we can't just say don't measure like what we did in the guideline that we did, the simplified the simplified lipid guidelines.
But yeah, we said you can check every 5 years if they're not on therapy to calculate risk, and then after that, if they start therapy, stop, don't measure anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And so the reason that we said why you don't do it if you start it is a couple of reasons. So if you give a statin, like at a low dose, sort of the 10 to 20 milligrams, on average, you will see a reduction in LDL cholesterol of 30 to 35%, depending on the drug that we're talking about. But that's not an unusual amount that you would see a reduction in. And it's reasonably consistent. Like it's most people get that reduction.
Yeah, statins are a tough foe. They get from you what they get from everybody else.
Yeah.
They do reduce. In there are exceptions for sure.
And, absolutely.
And then you have trouble finding out, are they taking their pills, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly.
But they get a pretty established benefit. What's also pretty interesting is, I think you're going to talk about, is how as you increase dose, you don't then go from a 35% reduction in LDL to a 70%
exactly.
when you double. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you, the average, so if you give a 10 milligram dose of the statin du jour, that gives you about 3/4 of the statin lowering effect that you would see from an 80 milligram. So for instance, if you give 10 milligrams, you'll see roughly let's say 30% reduction. If you increase that by eightfold to go to 80 milligrams, you get another 1/4 lowering. What that
Which
means
is a total of 40%.
Yeah. So instead of going from, so you can get 30 to 35. If you eightfold increase the dose, you might be able to get another 5 to 10% reduction in LDL cholesterol. So you see 30% with the first licking the tablet, if you will, and then you get another maybe 5 or 10% more. We've already talked about that the variation is around plus or minus 7%, and as Mike, you're correct, and you point out it may be even higher than that. So you can probably pick up the initial change of the 30%, but if you are increasing the dose, you can't. It just, you cannot pick that up. You will see changes again in cholesterol, but that's just the variation in the lab test.
I just got a letter asking me for someone on 40 of atorvastatin to check cholesterol, and if it's not at target, increase the atorvastatin dose and then repeat the LDL. I just got a letter.
And that's a person who is attempting to do a good job, sounds quite reasonable, but is clueless about the tests. And I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean,
it's hard to say someone's clueless without...
No, but I'll admit this. Until you really delve into this, I was clueless as to the magnitude of these things.
Yeah. Well, I would say you were clueless in a lot of things.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't count yourself short. This is just one area.
Yeah, there are many places. Yeah. So then do you measure it when you give the first dose of a cholesterol? Well, you can, but it's going to go down anyway. So, and you know, refer to our previous podcast to go about whether, you know, what to do about, you know, lipids changing or not changing, blah, blah, which drugs to use and all that sort of stuff. But if you're just strictly talking about statins and the issues of variability within that test, and we'll give you the actual numbers, not again in this podcast, it's the third one, maybe. Maybe we'll even go to a fourth that we're going to talk about this. Oh, the suspense. We're brilliant marketers. So, so we've talked a little bit about, I did my best and I think you helped out a lot, Mike, doing the, trying to understand what we call by this reference change value and the variation and so on associated with it. And we gave you a couple of examples of things like bone density and LDL cholesterol. So the next podcast, we'll talk about measurements associated with blood pressure, glucose, we'll dabble with vitamin D. And then, as you're all waiting for it, we're going to get to the now what? Now what do we do? And that will probably, maybe not even be the next podcast, but certainly within the next...
The next 12.
Within the next 12, we will make the point.
We will give you something you can use. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, yeah. So feel free to slog your course that no one ever attends other than the 400 people.
The 450 and the other 100 last year that were doing it. Yeah. I think they've heard enough of that. Yeah, we're going to – and I think close to the time I will be riding it like a rented mule. So.
Yeah. And then our one in Vancouver is May 4th and 5th, 2018. Please continue to go to our website and check out the other things that we have. We have links to much of the stuff that we do outside of this. Check out the tools for practice that are done. They're coming out at an unbelievable pace.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Yeah, every 2 weeks, which they have been for the last...
yes, for eight years.
Is it 8 years now? Yeah. So check those out, and I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.